Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
A day after addressing the nation on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, President Bush attended the National Day of Prayer and Remembrance Service this morning at Washington's National Cathedral. In his speech last night, President Bush outlined what he called one of the largest reconstruction efforts the world has ever seen.
Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives. And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know. There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
Newspaper editorials across the country today largely agree that the president's speech was a good first step, but the Denver Post writes that the president did a disservice to the country last night by failing to offer any proposals for where that extra money will come from. And as the Dallas Morning News writes, it's now all about results for the citizens, for the Gulf Coast, and for his presidency. Well, we begin with a look at what's ahead for the president and the country with former presidential advisor and Harvard professor David Gergen. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Has served in the administrations of Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. So your first thoughts on the speech?
Well, I thought the speech moved the country forward into a new phase, away from the first phase of suffering and stumbling by the government into a new phase where people are going to start to pull together and try to rebuild that region. I do think that the emphasis now is on results and should be. But the stories coming out of the Gulf area find that the evacuees are felt comforted and reassured by the speech, that they thought now for the first time there was a serious effort by the government to be on their side.
Well, we're going to talk more about that in a second, but you say move the country forward. Does the president also seem a step behind? He's declared today the National Day of Prayer, for instance. It's 3 weeks after the hurricane. Let's listen to Reginald Jackson, president of the Black Ministers' Council of New Jersey.
Prayer is always in order. The issue is many of us across the country have been lifting up the victims of Hurricane Katrina in prayer for the last several weeks.
And sort of staying on that note, David Gergen, the criticism is that he didn't name someone to coordinate the relief effort. He didn't say where the money was going to come from. I mean, do you have questions as well?
Oh, sure. I think you have to put the questions within the overall context. Look, at least he's taking responsibility, stepping up to the plate, and at least he's acknowledging that there's a racial and class problem here, a poverty problem, and that's rare in this president. Both of those are rare in this president. So that's forward progress. But there are, of course, shortcomings in the speech that are pretty obvious. There's no price tag. Nobody knows how much this is going to cost. And what the ultimate responsibility of the federal government is going to be. There's no call for sacrifice here. How are we going to pay for this? I think there are many of us who feel if you're going to spend $200 billion plus at the federal level, you've got to find that money somewhere else.
Well,
the obvious answer is to reduce the tax cuts.
Well, there's another answer for many Americans. As you know, polls say that people want that money to come from Iraq and be transferred to Hurricane Katrina relief. I want to ask you as well about the words that we just heard from President Bush. He said, "We will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes." Meaning,
very reminiscent of Iraq itself, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a false choice to say we can either do Katrina or can do Iraq. We have to choose between the two. There are other options. One of them is to raise taxes. Another is to stop some of these tax cuts or restore some of the tax cuts that were previously enacted. Another is to take money out of the spending side. That's a much harder proposition right now, although there's a lot of pork barrel. I mean, they could take that transportation bill that they recently passed where they built bridges to nowhere in Alaska and start building levees that go somewhere important in New Orleans. It does put pressure on the president to settle the Iraq thing perhaps faster than he has capability of doing. But it's clear that I think a lot of Americans are not going to be comfortable by trying to pay for Katrina, paying for Iraq, going forward with tax cuts and just borrowing our way to prosperity. I don't think anybody feels that that's a proper formula.
David Gergen, it's funny, by the way, that you mentioned removing pork and sending it to the Gulf area. We had a woman on the program yesterday who suggested just that. It regarded a parking garage in Bozeman, and we're going to have some response to that from other people in Bozeman. But
sure.
Yeah, people are, in other words, people are making suggestions, and I guess you're saying we need to hear more from the president.
Absolutely. And the other two things, there is no czar. And I think that's a mistake. He needs somebody at the federal level, not to run the state of Mississippi or to run the state of Louisiana, but to be the point person, the control person for the federal response. Because as a governor Blanco calls Washington and say, I need this and need that, you can't ask her to call 10 different cabinet officers. There's got to be one person who is responsible for this. That's what we did in Homeland Security after 9/11. You know, he brought in Tom Ridge. That was one person everybody looked to knock heads together. And in this case, there has to be someone like a Jack Welch or a Tommy Franks. Those are two names that are in circulation, or a Colin Powell, who can do that within the federal level. And finally, I must say that I was disappointed there was no sense of real accountability here on what happened. It's fine to say you take responsibility. I think that's important. But the country needs deeper answers. After 9/11, over much resistance from the White House, we finally got a 9/11 commission, and that commission just did first-rate work. It's one of the best commissions we've had in a long, long time. They really helped us to unearth problems, and they are right now, you know, they're saying, here's some problems we've got from Katrina. We need another 9/11 commission. Indeed, it seems to me the 9/11 commission we have could be asked to take this on as an additional contribution to the country. And I bet a number of them would be willing to do that.
David Gergen, former presidential advisor, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. David, thanks.
Thank you.
And we're joined now by Ellis Coates, a columnist at Newsweek magazine, who often writes about race and class in America. And Ellis, welcome. And through that prism and your own personal prism, if you'd like, your thoughts, first of all, on last night's speech.
Well, I thought it was a good speech. I mean, I think it was good that he basically acknowledged the difficult road ahead, that he pledged some resources to the task, that he acknowledged America's and Louisiana's and New Orleans' racial history, and that there was a firm commitment to rebuild. But I think it was one of these speeches that, in a sense, raised a lot more questions than it answered.
What are some of yours?
Well, for one thing, I mean, New Orleans needs to be not just rebuilt, but rethought. And this speech gives us little insight, if any, into how that process is going to take place. And for instance, I mean, if you look at large cities in the South, before Katrina hit, New Orleans was the most segregated, with two exceptions, Birmingham and Miami. It was hemorrhaging people, and it was hemorrhaging money. People were fleeing the city. It was a city in deep trouble. So to say that we're going to rebuild New Orleans is not to say enough. Well, the question that really raises is, how are we going to build New Orleans, and how are we going to rethink New Orleans?
Right. You write that the president said, out of New Orleans is going to come that great city again, and you are saying that some people didn't think it was all that great on certain levels.
Well, certainly in many respects, it was unmistakably great. I mean, what it's known for, it's music, it's nightlife, it's culinary expertise. Those are clearly parts and components of a great city. But if you take the city as a whole, what you're looking at is a city that was in deep, deep trouble. And to just talk about rebuilding it is not to talk about what needs to be done.
So, Ellis Coates, we want to hear more of your ideas, but just briefly, what would you have liked to have heard the president say that would have addressed this in your mind?
Well, it's not so much what he said last night. I mean, I think the speech last night was good for what it was. It was a late speech in terms of trying to pull the nation together and acknowledge what has happened, and however inadequately acknowledge responsibility and a pledge to go forward. That's probably enough for one speech to do. I think that the question, though, is what's going to happen after this, and what are the speeches, what are the policies, what are the practices that we're going to see moving forward, and that's just not very clear. And given the history of this particular president, it's not something we can just take for granted.
Well, and what do you mean by that?
Well, this is not a president who's focused really on issues of poverty, who's focused on issues of rebuilding urban America, and certainly who is not focused on issues of establishing and reestablishing a strong business base among small businesses and among minority businesses. Mm-hmm. And I think all of those are issues that the aftermath of Katrina raises, and they are not necessarily issues that have to be dealt with today or yesterday. but they're going to have to be dealt with fairly quickly as America and as New Orleans moves on.
So it sounds as if, Ellis Coast, you'd like to hear from this administration that there will be some plan to rebuild the city so that it is integrated, so that there is less of a class distinction as well as a color divide?
So that it is integrated, so that it is vitalized, so that it is a city that the middle class, black and white alike, want to live in.
Right.
And that is not the New Orleans that we saw destroyed. And that is New Orleans that needs to replace that New Orleans.
As you write, before the great exodus that we just saw, there's been an exodus of middle class blacks to places like Atlanta. Well, I want to ask John Harwood to join us as well. John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And John, you wrote yesterday about President Bush's rating as a crisis manager declining. Now, some might say one speech can't stop that kind of a slide, but one speech once did, you know, that bullhorn moment on 9/11 or post-9/11. So, John Harwood, what did you think of last night's speech?
Well, there's not going to be a bullhorn moment for this president in this crisis. We're too far down the road for that. I thought the president's speech last night was effective. I happened to be watching it with an advisor to Hillary Clinton who found Clinton-esque touches in the scope of what the president was talking about, efforts to help businesses and workers and repair infrastructure and education and training subsidies and that sort of thing. But the question is, what is the follow-through? Can you carry it out? And he's got a real risk that he alienates people on both sides of the political spectrum, conservatives who are already complaining about the costs of a recovery plan for the Gulf Coast, and liberals who say he's trying to slip in a bunch of ideological hobby horses that he hasn't been able to get through, school vouchers, that sort of thing, that haven't gotten through on normal channels. So it's a juggling act he faces, and as you know, his standing is now lower than it's been throughout his presidency.
Well, John Harwood, we want to talk about just those things after the break, but before we do that, I know Ellis Coase from Newsweek magazine, I know you have to go, but before you do, you've been talking about what you would like to see in the rebuilding of New Orleans, but I wonder, just to get to the distinct question of whether or not President Bush spoke to African Americans who, by a huge number, 70% I think that the response to the hurricane would have been different if most of the victims on television had been white. Do you think he addressed that issue?
Well, I think he tried to, and I think he began to. And again, as it is in general, I think the larger set of questions now is what happens going forward. I mean, I don't think one speech is going to convince anyone who's not convinced already that President Bush has either poor people or certainly poor black people as a group that he cares about. And I think this is an opportunity for him to turn that set of perceptions around, but it's not going to happen overnight, and it's certainly not going to happen magically.
Ellis Coase, columnist at Newsweek magazine. Thanks for your time, Ellis.
It's been my pleasure.
We've also got John Harwood with us. He's national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. He raised some intriguing thoughts right now. Is there a political agenda already at work in how this reconstruction might go forward? What impact is it having on President Bush's core constituency that the price for this rebuilding of the Gulf Coast is ballooning to perhaps $300 billion? Certainly that's not small government by any definition. We'll take a look at these issues and others and also speak to some people from the area waiting to hear what President Bush had to say. We'll get their response. That's all coming up next. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Speech last night and how the nation can now move forward after Hurricane Katrina. In a moment, we're going to hear from a man in Gulfport, Mississippi. Like many, they didn't really see it as much as they heard about it. Not a lot of electricity in some of those areas down there. But first, John Harwood's on the line from the Wall Street Journal. And John, you just mentioned something that's intriguing. What impact is the recovery effort and the ballooning number of what it might cost to recover in the coast? What impact is that having on President Bush's core constituency?
Well, it hasn't had a dramatic impact so far, but it's a danger for him, and it's one that he hasn't really had to confront for most of his presidency. This is a Republican president who has had unprecedented support within his party, but one of the things that we've seen over the last few months is some beginnings of erosion in that base. He's adopted a strategy through most of his presidency of first trying to please conservatives and building out from there. Now he's hemorrhaging big time in the center of the electorate, but he's also seeing some Republicans peel off, some starting to complain about the price tag of Katrina, and perhaps some of those concerns may be exacerbated as we move forward and the president feels the need to strike quick deals to get this package through. So that's a consideration that they have to keep in mind because their governing strategy is under some pressure right now.
But does he have any choice? I mean, former Speaker Newt Gingrich points out if he comes down for boldness, you know, a big, bold rebuilding effort, he's Teddy Roosevelt. If he doesn't, the Democrats win in 2006 and 2008.
Well, that's true. But the question is, what's bold? Is bold large in terms of the price tag, or is bold in terms that Newt Gingrich could relate to proposing innovative free market solutions?
Right,
you know,
right.
Both impulses are present, and how he juggles those two is going to be a key to exactly politically how this comes out for him.
Well, speaking of those free market solutions, your paper is written about something called the Republican Study Group, an influential caucus of conservative House members, and a group that's been meeting in closed session to discuss ways to sort of implement that sort of free market, conservative market agenda.
Well, this is fascinating. You may remember, Robin, that this same thing came up after the fall of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and a lot of the conservatives were saying, now we have a clean slate to try to implement in that country some of the ideas that we think are right, the flat tax, for example, that sort of thing.
And as your John Wilkie, your colleague, writes, Bush administration has suspended some union-friendly rules, moved to ease tariffs on Canadian lumber, allowed more foreign sugar imports, again, waived some affirmative action rules for employers with federal contracts in the Gulf region in an effort, they would say, to move ahead the reconstruction, but some others would say to enforce an agenda.
Well, exactly, and Democrats are going to highlight every instance of those and say, look, they're trying to use a national crisis to accomplish ideological goals that they couldn't get in normal times. It's a very big challenge. I just got off the phone a few minutes ago with Bobby Jindal, who's a conservative member of Congress from the affected area, from Louisiana, and he said, we simply don't have time to do partisan or ideological fights. We've got to come up with pragmatic solutions kind of quickly. And as you suggested a moment ago, I think that is probably going to be the dominant pressure that he faces. But how he resolves these pressures isn't always predictable.
Well, on the other hand, some would say the Democrats are also trying to enforce their own ideology. Richard Durbin of Illinois suggesting creating a national emergency airlift program in times of emergency. So some might point fingers at that as well. But,
oh, sure.
Yeah, we want to turn now to Riley Morse. He's a lawyer in Gulfport, Mississippi, although in title only at the moment. He lost his office. His home survived the storm. He was only able to hear bits and pieces of the speech last night because he was meeting with neighbors talking about the rebuilding effort. And, Riley, we understand in large parts of the region people couldn't see anything at all because the electricity is still out. But what are your neighbors saying? What are you hearing?
Well, that meeting I had involved a series of people who've been involved in community and environmental activism, and so the discussion there was the idea that if this does create a clean slate, part of the rebuilding effort is going to be to try to strip away a lot of the environmental and zoning protections and precautions to speed up the reconstruction process. And that is causing problems already. The Mississippi Gulf Coast has a beachfront highway. 3 miles of centuries-old live oaks were knocked down, sawed down by state highway department people because the tree protection people couldn't stay ahead of the track hose chopping stuff down. And I think that's a precursor of what's going to be coming here. I think the people on the at the state and local level have got to absolutely take a big, deep breath, pull down all the studies off the shelf, take a hard look at how they want this thing, how this coast should rebuild, if they want to see something come up that they can be proud of again.
Well, Riley Morse, what is the first thing that people in your region need?
I think that we're past the point of having, you know, the immediate ice and water handled. I think that the point right now that we need is we need to be able to have the basic operational needs for people, the food and the housing. I think the housing is a severe problem in a lot of the affected area here. And then the government, the local governments in particular, need to not be pushed into making sudden rash decisions. And they need the time, and we need the the support in the meantime to enable people to recuperate in a sensible way and in a prudent way.
Riley Morris from Gulfport, Mississippi, has to get back to the work of rebuilding his neighborhood. Riley, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And John Harwood, I think we just heard what may be a conflict down the road, but also, you know, I could hear the Bush administration saying we got people yelled at us when we went too slow, and now they're angry that we might be going too fast.
Oh, well, there's no doubt that in a crisis like this, you get it coming or going. But, you know, that's what you get paid the big bucks for, as it were. This is something the administration is going to have to cope with, the tension between federal control and state and local control. I talked to a Democratic mayor last night who said, oh, it sounds like the president, in reviewing all these municipal plans, is sort of blaming us for not being prepared. But it's clear the federal government has fallen down on the job, but he's got to involve local governments in the solutions.
And by the way, the White House has responded today to those questions of where will the money come from. I just want to have gotten this in. Al Hubbard, who's the director of Bush's National Economic Council, said it's coming from the American taxpayer. There will be, according to the White House, no budget cuts to offset the disaster expense. To be continued. John Harwood of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And there is much more ahead, so stay with us. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the
insurance coverage in the wake of Hurricane Katrina and its 30-foot storm surge, the biggest ever in North America, Mississippi has filed suit against insurers to try to force them to pay billions in flood damage. Insurance companies are balking, saying they only cover damage from wind-driven water, with payouts collected from premiums, while the federal government offers flood insurance backed by taxpayer dollars. Well, we're joined now by Bob Hunter, a director of insurance for the Consumer Federation of America. He was also insurance administrator for Presidents Ford and Carter. And Bob, so we understand, how much damage from a hurricane is from wind as opposed to flooding?
Most hurricanes are 90% or more wind damage and only 5 or 10% flood damage. Here we're talking very major flood damage, plus a very high percentage of flood insurance contracts in New Orleans. 40% or so of the people will have flood insurance, compared to the 10 or 15% around the nation for flood insurance. That's pretty good.
How big of an issue has this become that insurers are not covering some of the flood damage?
It's a very major issue because the flooding is so extensive, and the politicians are getting involved, and even President Bush has discussed the possibility of maybe finding something about flood insurance. Why isn't it more extensive? Which is a very interesting reminder of the fact that the flood program was started because of a flood in Independence, Missouri, where the exact same question was raised by President Truman, which led to the study of how to write flood insurance, and the National Flood Insurance Program was created.
So what do you think is going to happen? I mean, some are suggesting that the insurance companies might succumb to this pressure and allow for more flood damage coverage.
Well, you know, the insurance companies are private entities, and they aren't going to necessarily hand away money that they don't owe if they don't think they owe it. I suspect that they might be more lenient than at other times because they're going to be watched. We've asked that the GAO be called in by the Congress to monitor the payment of claims to make sure that wind is paid up to its maximum available amounts, both to protect taxpayers in the National Flood Insurance Program and to protect people who don't have flood insurance. I think what they would do is they'd say, all right, at least we'll go this far. To the extent that we know it's wind, we'll pay it. To the extent that we know it's flow, we may not. But if to the extent we have any doubt, we'll give the doubt to the insurance.
And by the way, as someone who has done this, how do you know?
Well, for example, you could have damaged furniture with a window broken and flood. How much of that was from the rain being driven in by the wind, which is covered, and how much of that was flood?
Couldn't you say a whole surge was wind?
You could also say that the surge had wind relation. Mm-hmm. You could say that the levee was topped because of the winds coming back after Hurricane Katrina passed New Orleans. The scenario was that Lake Pontchartrain was pushed by the wind to top the levees, and therefore there was a wind relation. I think there are already lawyers talking about making that case in a class action for those who don't have flood insurance.
Right. Well, and what happens then if insurers have to cover so much more
flood insurance damage? Industry is fortunately right now incredibly profitable. They had their highest profits in history in the first and second quarters of this year.
Then what happens, Bob Hunter, if there is a policy change, and as you said, people are saying there might be, and some of this flood damage is changed to wind damage and it's covered, what happens retroactively? Do you have hundreds of Americans saying, well, wait a minute, I didn't get covered?
You might, although that's wind has always been the vast majority of the claims in these hurricanes, so it's not likely that many people would say that.
What would you be advising Mississippi, Louisiana state directors to be encouraging insurers to do as they approach this?
I would look at the steps that the Florida took in the wake of Hurricane Andrew. They monitored the wind payments, and they said, all right, after 60 days, if you haven't paid a claim, we want a written report on why. And then after 90 days, we want an executive to come in and tell us why they haven't paid the claims. So they kept the pressure on the insurance companies to settle the claims. And they need to be ready if, in fact, what happens in Mississippi and Louisiana is like what happens in Florida in the wake of Hurricane Andrew, and some major company like Allstate threatens to non-renew or cancel a bunch of policyholders. They have to be ready to have a moratorium to not allow that to happen until they have time as the state to put structures in place, such as Citizens Insurance Company in Florida, to make sure people have a policy.
You know, we should also point out that it seems as if there are complaints about insurance coverage right now, but there are scenes of insurance adjusters just writing out checks left and right.
The early stages in the wake of a hurricane of insurance company treatment is usually pretty good, particularly while TV cameras are on. The real complaints will come later. The storm isn't over in terms of insurance. It's not even begun yet.
Bob Hunter, thanks so much.
Okay.
Bob Hunter, Director of Insurance for the Consumer Federation of America. Well, we have this quick follow-up to a story we told you about yesterday. Tracy Velasquez of Bozeman, Montana, wants that city to take the $4 million designated in the federal highway bill for a Bozeman parking garage and send it to the victims of Katrina. Well, the bipartisan city commission is considering her proposal. The Wall Street Journal is applauding the idea and urging other communities to also give up their federal park for Katrina relief. Well, hold on. We got an email yesterday from a listener who's also a state official in Montana. He said, wait a minute, we've been working for years to get money for Bozeman's first ever parking garage. And on the line we have another government official, Chris Pope. He's head of the Bozeman Parking Commission. And Chris, you also disagree with this idea of, quote, giving the money back. Why?
For starters, our hearts and souls go out to the communities in the Gulf. The funds that have been identified for a parking facility in Bozeman, which is essential to our long-term economic vitality, remain in Washington, D.C., and probably will for the next year. And even if they were available to the community to make decisions, in fact, they're very, very heavily donor-directed. We have to use those in a very explicit way. And if the community were to say that they wanted some choice in the matter, I don't think they'd have any choice.
Well, some people are saying that Ms. Velasquez might be politicizing things because she did once run for office as a Democrat. But even your senator, Max Baucus, is saying that he thinks it would be very difficult to return money because it's been legislated.
In the context of what's going on in today's world, in the South of the United States, I think all ideas are fair game. But this one in particular just simply doesn't have any starting point because this community doesn't have the funds to identify back into a pot for Katrina victims. And so as much as we are very concerned about those communities and are doing, there's several dozen initiatives in Bozeman to provide immediate support to those communities. At this point, this isn't an opportunity for our community to assist. You know, at the local level, this is not pork. This community has raised close to $4 million over the past 10 years through a tax increment finance bond. So we don't actually have the funds. We'll have to bond and commit ourselves for 20 years. And so those funds will go side by side with federal funds for a very, very essential piece of the future economy of our town.
Chris Pope, the head of the Bozeman Parking Commission in Bozeman, Montana. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, Robin.
So the debate continues in Bozeman and beyond. You're listening to Here and Now. Just a bit of the sound of the WNBA Finals, providing lovers of women's basketball everywhere something to cheer about. The Connecticut Sun and the Sacramento Monarchs are tied at one apiece in a five-game series after two opening games in Connecticut. The series moves to Sacramento this Sunday, and it's all we can do to keep NPR's Bill Littlefield from going along with them. Bill, host of Only a Game, joins us in the studio, one of the biggest fans of women's sports in general. Thank you for following this for us, as you have been. And last night, game two of the series, it went into overtime?
It went into overtime, and it was magnificently exciting. We had a three-pointer from with 2 seconds left to send the game into overtime, and then the Sun just dominated in overtime, shut out the Monarchs 7-0 and won the game 77-70.
And as exciting as that was, I hear there was a little too much excitement the night before.
Well, for people who weren't used to the fire pillars between which the Sun players had to run after they were introduced, the excitement was a little bit over the top.
A little singed.
And I did see at least one player, 7 foot 2 inch Margot Dedek, who looked very reluctant about running between the pillars and had to be kind of shoved from behind to go through with the whole spectacle.
Well, you know, they're trying to make it, you know, fun and a spectacle for family, but it's huge in Connecticut with the success of the UConn women's team. So were there a lot of people at the game?
Yeah, 8,200 for game one, 8,400 last night. So it's a great success in terms of drawing fans to the actual game, folks who pay to get in. And it was great. Both games were terrific.
Well, next year the WNBA is going to be celebrating its 10th anniversary. But I think you are still in more. Has the mourning period ended for you for women's professional soccer?
No, I'm in denial. I'm in denial. I believe okay. They're in recess, and any time now we'll hear the announcement that the league will be back in business.
Well, I don't know how to break it to you, but as you know, it failed. And some are, you know, crossing their fingers for the WNBA. Are they doing something differently? What do you think?
Well, the main thing that the WNBA is doing differently is they have the great and glorious power, financial and public relations power of the NBA behind them. And so the WNBA will not fail unless the NBA decides not to back it any longer, which I don't think is likely to happen. It's recognized as a good thing for owners whose arenas would otherwise be empty during the summer on a certain number of nights. And it's a good entertainment package for ESPN and some of the other outlets. So
and there are some terrific stars. Name a few.
Well, I have several favorites, and as far as I'm concerned, the star of the day is Brooke Wyckoff, who is the magnificently personable woman who sunk the three-pointer to tie the game last night. I talked to her after game one. Now, bear in mind, her team had just lost a heartbreaking game at home to lose the home court advantage, and I saw her in the corridor outside the locker room, and she was laughing and smiling and having a wonderful time. And I said, Brooke, how do you manage this kind of upbeat presence? And she said, it's a basketball game. You know, when all is said and done, we got to have fun, or what's the point? Yeah. And I just thought, oh, my goodness, everybody should hear this.
Well, and, you know, and it would be nice if everyone had that attitude, but it's also a profession. I mean, are they paid enough to, you know, keep it their profession?
The most kind of high profile among them is paid enough to do quite well. Most of them. It's not like being a Major League Baseball player, and certainly not like being an NBA player, where if you can hang around for 5 or 6 years and you're not badly advised by your agent, you probably are set for life. No, that's not the case with the WNBA. But on the other hand, they have an opportunity to play at the highest possible level in their own country without having to go overseas to continue their basketball.
Bill Littlefield of National Public Radio's Only a Game, where you will hear more about women's basketball this weekend. But, Bill, as we listen a little now, who do you think is going to take it all?
I have no idea.
Oh,
this
good.
Series has started off so magnificently. The Monarchs coach said it very well the other night. I don't know either. It could go either way.
Which is what makes it so much fun.
Absolutely.
Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Again, be sure to check out NPR's Only a Game. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. And Doyers Streets in New York City's Chinatown. You see a big yellow arrow pointing to the intersection with a phone number and a code, so you dial the numbers, and this is what you hear.
This street is always nicknamed Bloody Elbow, Bloody Angle, because back in the days of the Five Points, there'd be a lot of gangs roaming here, the Irish and Italian gangs, and also Chinese gangs in the 70s and 80s would settle their disputes here because there'd be a lot of escape paths. So before the police ever came here, this was known to be a meeting spot for gangs to resolve their issues here.
Well, you might not know this corner as the Bloody Elbow, but Jamie Gong does because he grew up there. Jamie is one of dozens of locals who narrate notable locations for Yellow Arrow, The Secret New York, a public art project that's been sprinkling yellow arrows all over the five boroughs of New York City since June 2005. Jesse Chapins is an artist and creative development manager for Counts Media, based in New York City, and he's lead developer for the project. He joins us now. Jesse, welcome.
Hi.
Jesse has also recruited storytellers and audio producers such as Nathan Phillips, who also joins us from New York. Nathan, hi.
Hi there.
And Jesse, let's start with you. The Secret New York is an outgrowth of a global Yellow Arrow project. Tell us about that.
Yellow Arrow is a global public art project that started a little over a year and a half ago here in New York City. Began at a psychogeography conference called The Conflux.
I have to stop you there. Psychogeography?
It's a term that first was coined in the 50s by artists in the Netherlands and in France and Europe generally. They were very interested in the sort of emotional impacts of the environment upon people's perception. And so conceived in many different ways of sort of changing your everyday relationship with a place. So one of the most classic things that was always conceived by the psychogeographers was to randomly walk along streets as opposed to your normal everyday route between point A and B, to intentionally find ways to walk that you normally wouldn't and imagine what you might come across.
Well, and that's what happens with the Secret New York Tour. It's a walk where you might suddenly see these yellow arrows. How did you decide where to put the arrows?
We focused on doing a process of urban research where we would look at an area and be down in the streets talking to people, trying to figure out what would be interesting people to speak to, what are the special stories of these places. And in that process would come across an individual that would have a remarkable story to tell about a specific place.
I'll say, I'm thinking of the huge thing at A and B. Nathan, you're the narrator on several of the pieces posted online, and I want you to tell us about this one because I just love this. It's the work of folk artist Eddie Burroughs on Avenue B and East 6th Street.
It's a really interesting sculpture, and it's constantly photographed, and he's just a member of this garden who, over the course of a number of years, has taken up more and more space, and he's built this enormous collection of wood and toys that seems like it could fall over at any second.
Well, here's a little bit of what you hear when you see the arrow at the big thing on Avenue B and East 6th Street and call the number. Here's a little.
This one here I built with good lumber. It might look like it's shabby, but it'll never come down. This has been up 13 years now, and it's never fallen. I've been hearing stories from people in the neighborhood. They tell me, whatever you do, don't take it down. It belongs here. You know, it belongs to the neighborhood somehow. I really don't know why, but there's a lot of people who really love that damn thing.
So that's the huge thing at A and B. And Nathan Phillips, again, one of the leading designers of this secret tour in New York, it raises the question, you know, there are going to be people who are thrilled to have these things pointed out to them. There are going to be people who are going to hate you for this because these are the hidden treasures of New York City. Do you worry about that, that now maybe Eddie's sculpture has been jeopardized?
You know, in the East Village where Eddie's sculpture is, we had 11 arrows up. And over the course of the 2 or 3 weeks I was down there making interviews and setting up the project, by the end of the second week, I couldn't walk from one arrow to the next without someone stopping on a moped and being, you know, oh, you know what you should point out, and telling me about this underground jazz club, or somebody stopping me and saying, you know, these big yellow things are really ugly. What's the big idea? They're all over the neighborhood, and explaining the project to them, and people definitely have opinions about them. A lot of them are positive. Some of them are negative, but it definitely engages
it's art.
The audience.
It's art, yeah.
I mean,
it's
I think art. One person came up to me and was quite intense about thinking this was an extreme commercialization of the area, that it was worse than having Starbucks on every corner even. He thought it was really just directed exclusively to tourists and was a means of bringing, you know, outsiders in to look at the area. When I explained to him sort of the process that we go through in developing the pieces and how the audience is really visitors on one hand, but it's really the residents of the city, and it's uncovering the secret New York for New Yorkers.
Well, here's one, in fact, about Freddy's, which is a dive bar in Prospect Heights. Again, there will be a yellow arrow at Freddy's if you dial the phone number on it and put in the code. Here's a little of what you hear.
I scan the groups of people. You're not with the blonde boy with the sweet smile, the 7-foot-tall mathematician, the guy with the mutton chops. You're not with the regulars telling stories. You're not with the guy explaining his new watch. You're not with the girl who's had too many $2 Bud Lights. I sit next to the other woman alone at the bar. We stir our drinks. The jukebox plays.
Nathan, who was that narrating the Freddy's piece?
That's a woman named Johanna Lindsley, who is a member of our Yellow Arrow community, which is people who are interested in the project. And it's a really diverse group of people.
Jesse Chapin's, again, one of the designers of this secret New York. How many phone calls did you ultimately get? How many people did call in after seeing the arrows and the phone numbers?
Throughout the entire summer, we've received nearly 10,000 phone calls. And it's been a varying sort of degrees of excitement and interest. And, for example, as Nathan was describing, one of our largest installations was in the East Village for the Howl Festival, and where there was very broad community support and excitement, and we had 11 arrows put up. And during that 1 week, we received a little over 2,500 calls. Mm. And people really listening and spending at least 2 minutes on their phone, really becoming engaged in listening to the stories.
You know, it's sort of as if people could stand there with their cell phones, and instead of actually talking to, Eddie Burroughs, whose sculpture is there, and somebody at Freddy's, they could stand there on their cell phone and have their interaction with New York be through a website.
Part of the interview process is actually when I'm talking to the people who were interviewing, and letting them know that really they have the opportunity to stop people on the street, they could be any random passerby, and just speak directly into their ear and point their eyes at different things, point out, you know, interesting architectural things or interesting color schemes that they might not have noticed, and also tell them these interesting stories, like the stories of the flying dragons and the ghost shadows in Chinatown, or pointing out, you know, why Eddie Burroughs picked the toys that he picked.
Yeah. So it could hopefully lead to people actually speaking to each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Jesse Chapin's artist and creative development manager for Counts Media. They're the designers of the Secret New York Yellow Arrow project. And Nathan Phillips, a storyteller and audio producer who's also part of the project. Thanks to you both for telling us about it.
Thank you very much.
You'll find a link to hear the stories or to download Yellow Arrow podcasts on our website, here-now.org.
We'll have Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten Island too. It's lovely going through the zoo.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Delancey Street, you know, the subway charms us so when balmy breezes blow to and fro. And tell me what street compares with Mott Street in July. Sweet push carts gently gliding by.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
We'll turn Manhattan into an island of joy.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and